And I guess everybody here is a dignitary, and I appreciate your help. And by the way, I am serious about the food. Bring in, don't slow down. So just come in, clear the places, but Hillary has to eat her beets. Because the table is small enough and the room is intimate enough, I'd like to spend our time responding to questions you have, listening to advice you might have. Occasionally, as I did just a moment ago, I get envelopes like that, which is, and I'll open this and there'll be campaign ideas. Why don't you talk about the following issue? So I'm happy to take advice, and then we can all vote on whether it's a good piece of advice or bad advice. And so we'll get a chance to do that. But I'm looking to get your perspectives. I just tell you a couple of things you may not know about me. You probably know that I'm father of five and grandfather now of 18. My oldest son just had two twins just last week, and so our grandchild nest is getting larger, and they're a source of great joy. When I was probably halfway through my career at Bain Consulting, I met with a lawyer to draft a will. And she said, "How do you want to divide what estate you might eventually have?" And I said, I didn't have anything at that point. I said, "I want to divide it equally among my five sons." And she said, "Well, how much will you want to give to the grandchildren that they will ultimately have?" And I said, "Well, I don't want to give anything to the grandchildren. I'll give it to the sons, and they in turn will give it to their children as needed." And she said, "You'll change your mind." I said, no, I don't think so. So I saw her not long ago, and I said, "I don't want to give anything to my sons. I want to give it to my
you've lost Samantha's vote.
This
is my daughter.
It's not just because I love my grandchildren as I do. I love my sons and daughters-in-law. It's that I'm very concerned about what the nation is going to be like over the coming decade or two. And I really do. As I said in my remarks earlier, I see these two very different scenarios. One is America really powering the world economy with an extraordinary economy here, with China working with us, wanting to see stability in the world, and a very vibrant America with freedom and prosperity for the great bulk of the American people. On the other hand, I really do see something like Europe, and I think that's the path we're on right now. So that's why I want to make sure that what little I'll have left after the campaigns goes to my grandchildren. That's one piece about me that you may not know. The other is just about my heritage. My dad, you probably know, was the governor of Michigan and was the head of a car company, but he was born in Mexico. And had he been born of Mexican parents, I'd have a better shot of winning this, but he was unfortunately born of Americans living in Mexico. They lived there for a number of years, and I say that jokingly, but it would be helpful to be Latino. Pardon? That's right. That's right. I can go out and say, those that don't know Elizabeth Warren, she is the woman who's running for U.S. Senate in Massachusetts, who said that she's Cherokee, and has put in her application over the years that she's Cherokee, and Harvard put down that she's one of their minority faculty members. It turns out that at most she's 1/32nd for Cherokee, and even that can't be proven. So in any event, I can put down my dad was born in Mexico and leave it at that. But his dad was in construction, very successful in Mexico, but in America went broke more than once. So my dad never had the money or time to get a college degree. Without a college degree, became head of a big car company and ultimately a governor. And believed in America, believed in the opportunity of this country, never doubted for a moment that he could achieve his dreams. And Ann's dad, my wife's dad, was born in Wales. His dad was a coal miner. This coal miner got injured in a coal mining accident, realizing that there was no future there for him or his four children. He came to Detroit and worked in the auto factories until he could save enough money to bring his kids over, which he did. And then they got together as a family and said, you know, to be successful in America, you've got to get an education. And they couldn't afford an education. And the kids and the parents said, you know, if we all work and we all save, we could afford to send one of us to college. And they sent my wife's dad. Can you imagine working every day, taking a couple of jobs and saving your money so that your brother could go to, I mean, I would never do that for my brother. So he went to college and got a degree at the General Motors Institute of Technology, which is one of these programs where you work a semester and then you go to school a semester. And then after it was over, he started a little company and he became more successful, and he was able to hire his brothers and his brother-in-law and provide for them in an extraordinary way. By the way, both my dad and Ann's dad did quite well in their life, but when they came to the end of their lives and passed along the inheritances to Ann and to me, we both decided to give it all away. So I have inherited nothing. Everything that Ann and I have, we earned the old-fashioned way, and that's by hard work. I see that only
you
because...
You just lost Amanda's vote for a second time.
I say that because there's a perception that, oh, you were born with a silver spoon, you know, you never had to earn anything and so forth. And frankly, I was born with a silver spoon, which is the greatest gift you can have, which is to get born in America. I'll tell you, 95% of life is set up for you if you're born in this country. And I remember going sorry just to bore you with stories, but when I was back in my private equity days, we went to China to buy a factory there. It employed about 20,000 people. And they were almost all young women between the ages of about 18 and 22 or 23. They were saving for potentially becoming married, and they worked in these huge factories. They made various small appliances. And as we were walking through this facility, seeing them work, the number of hours they worked per day, the pittance they earned, living in dormitories with little bathrooms at the end of maybe 10 rooms. And the rooms, they had 12 girls per room, three bunk beds on top of each other. And you've seen them.
Oh, yeah.
And around this factory was a fence, a huge fence of barbed wire and guard towers. And we said, gosh, I can't believe that you keep these girls in. They said, no, this is to keep other people from coming in, because people want so badly to come work in this factory that we have to keep them out, or they'll just come in here and start working and try and get compensated. So this is to keep people out. And they said, actually, at Chinese New Year, as the girls go home, sometimes they decide they've saved enough money and they don't come back to the factory. And he said, and so on the weekend after Chinese New Year, there'll be a line of people, hundreds long, outside the factory, hoping that some girls haven't come back and they can come to the factory. And so as we were experiencing this for the first time, we came to see a factory like this in China some years ago, the main partner I was with turned to me and said, you know, 95% of life is settled if you're born in America. This is an amazing land. And what we have is unique, and fortunately it is so special, we're sharing it with the world. I'm concerned about the future, but also optimistic, as I said, and I look forward to getting America back on track and having people plan on bringing their ideas and their dreams to this country. We need big dreamers, by the way. Oh, we didn't talk about immigration today. Gosh, I'd like to bring in more legal immigrants that have skill and knowledge. I'd like to staple a green card to every PhD in the world and say, come to America, we want you here. Instead, we make it hard for people who get educated here or elsewhere to make this their home. Unless, of course, you have no skill or experience, in which case you're welcome to cross the border and stay here the rest of your life. It's a very strange setting run by people who don't understand that we're in a global competition of ideas. And our idea has to win, but only if America remains strong. Well, with that as an introduction, I'm going to turn to you for counsel, advice, or questions, policy questions. Want to talk about tax policy or political questions, how I win, please.
One comment, Governor.
Yes.
The debates are going to be coming, and I hope at the right moment you can turn to President Obama, look at the American people and say, if you vote to re-elect President Obama, you're voting to bankrupt the United States. I hope you keep that in your quiver, because that's what's going to happen, and I think it's going to be very effective. I just want to make that.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's the former head of Goldman Sachs, John Whitehead, was also the former head of the New York Federal Reserve, and I met with him, and he said, as soon as the Fed stops buying all the debt that we're issuing, which they've been doing, the Fed's buying like 3/4 of the debt that America issues. He says, what's that over? That's over. He said, we're going to have a failed Treasury auction. Interest rates are going to have to go up. We're living in this borrowed fantasy world where the government keeps on borrowing money. You know, we borrow this extra trillion a year. We wonder, well, who's loaning us a trillion? The Chinese aren't loaning us anymore. The Russians aren't loaning it to us anymore. So who's giving us a trillion? And the answer is, we're just making it up. The Federal Reserve is just taking it and saying, here, we're giving it. It's just made up money. And this does not augur well for our economic future. Some of these things are complex enough. It's not easy for people to understand. But your point of saying bankruptcy usually concentrates the mind. Yeah, George?
Governor, to your point on complexity.
Yeah.
How, as you travel around America and talk to people in larger groups and perhaps people with different backgrounds than people in this room, to what extent do people really understand that we're hurtling toward a cliff? And to what extent do people really understand the severity of the fiscal situation we're in? Do people get it?
They don't. I mean, by and large, people don't get it. People in our party, in part it's our fault because we've been talking about deficits and debt for about 25 or 30 years as a party, and so they've heard us say it and say it and say it. The fact that Greece is going through what it's going through, and they read about France and Italy and Spain, has finally made this issue topical for the American people. And so when you do polls and you ask people what is the biggest issue in the 2012 election, number one is the economy and jobs by a wide margin, but number two is the deficit. But debt and that doesn't calculate for both, but the deficit does. They recognize you can't go on forever like this. Although the people who recognize that tend to be Republican, and the people who don't recognize it tend to be Democrat. And what we have to get is that 5 or 10% in the middle, who sometimes vote Republican, sometimes vote Democrat, and have them understand how important this is. It's a challenge. I did the calculation for folks today, and USA Today publishes this every year. It's a front page story, the headline once a year, but somewhat escapes people's attention. And that is, if you take the total national debt and the unfunded liabilities of Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid, the amount of debt plus unfunded liabilities per household in America is $520,000 per household.
It's like 12 times the rate.
Right. At least, 10, 12 times their income, and even though we're not going to be writing a check for that amount per household, they're going to be paying the interest on that. You will be paying the interest on that because my generation will be long gone, and you'll be paying the interest, and so you'll be paying taxes not only for the things you want in your generation, but for all the things we spent money on. Which is just, it's extraordinary to think that tax rates, someone calculated what would happen if we don't change Medicare or Social Security. The tax rate, you know what the payroll tax is now, it's 15.3%. If we don't change those programs, that tax rate will have to ultimately rise to 44%, the payroll tax. Then there's the income tax on top, which the president wants to take to 40%. Then there's state tax in most states. And sales tax and so you end up having to take 100% of people's income. And yet the president, 3.5 years in, won't talk about reforming Social Security or Medicare. And when the Republicans do, it's you're throwing granny off the cliff. It's like, you're killing the kids. The biggest surprise that I have is that young people will vote for a Democrat. They look at this and say, holy cow, the only guys that are worried about the future of our country and our future are Republicans. But the Democrats, they talk about social issues, draw in the young people, and they vote on that issue. It's like, there won't be any houses like this if we stay on the road we're on. Please? Yeah. I heard a voice. I'm sorry, please.
Dr. Romney, we are former Bostonians.
Oh.
Yeah. We'll talk about how we know you.
Good. Yeah, okay.
Totally agree with what you said economically. But I would like to know And I would like you, and I would like there to be much more discussion on what I consider the real big issues, and where the issues are around, and how would your point of view differ from President Obama's?
Yeah, thank you. And I, and by the way, start eating. Those of, those of you who have food in front of you, it's warm, and start eating. This is meant to, I'm standing up so I can see you, but I'm not standing up so that you have to stop and look at me. So, and it's important to look at your food as you're eating it. All right. Don't want to see you putting a fork in your finger here. You are right, which is a nuclear Iran is an unthinkable outcome, not just for our friends in Israel and our friends in Europe, but also for us, because Iran is the state sponsor of terror in the world, has Hezbollah now throughout Latin America, Hezbollah with missile material. I mean, if I were Iran, and a crazed fanatic, I'd say, let's get a little missile material to Hezbollah, have them carry it to Chicago or some other place, and then if anything goes wrong or America starts acting up, we'll just say, hey, guess what? Unless you stand down, why, we're going to let off a dirty bomb. I mean, this is where we head, where America can be held up and blackmailed by Iran, by the mullahs, by crazy people. So we really don't have any option but to keep Iran from having a nuclear weapon. I'll give the specific on Iran, and then maybe talk more broadly about foreign policy. The specific on Iran is we should have put in place crippling sanctions at the beginning of the president's term. We did not. He will say, yes, but Russia wouldn't go along with this. Well, he gave Russia their number one foreign policy objective. For a decade, all they've cared about is getting the missile defense sites out of Poland. And he gave them that and got nothing in return. He could have, I presume, gotten them to agree to crippling sanctions against Iran. He did not, which is, in my opinion, one of the greatest foreign policy errors of the modern time. And by the way, if he could not have gotten that from Russia, he should have kept the missile defense sites in Poland, just to keep a bargaining chip on the table. I mean, you know, put nothing in him if he wants to. I mean, I would have kept them. I would have traded them away, but that's where he was. Number two, we should have been aggressively supporting the voices of dissent in Iran. And when there was an effort towards revolution there, we should have been aggressively supporting it. And finally, we should have made it clear, at least by now, that we have military plans to potentially remove their nuclear capabilities. That doesn't mean we actually pull the trigger, but it means that we communicate to them that we're ready to do so, and that it is unacceptable to America to have a nuclear Iran. Instead, what this administration has done is communicate to the Iranians that we're more worried about Israel attacking them than we are about them becoming nuclear. It's just, it's extraordinary. So those are some thoughts directly on Iran. I'll step back on foreign policy. The president's foreign policy, in my opinion, is formed in part by a perception he has that his magnetism and his charm and his persuasiveness is so compelling that he can sit down with people like Putin and Chavez and Ahmadinejad, and they'll find we're such wonderful people that they'll go along with us. And they'll stop doing bad things. And it's an extraordinarily naive perception, and it has led to huge errors in North Korea, in Iraq, obviously in Iran, in Egypt, around the world. My own view is that the centerpiece of American foreign policy has to be strength. Everything I do will be calculated to increasing America's strength. When you stand by your allies, you increase your strength. When you attack your allies, you become weaker. When you stand by your principles, you get stronger. When you have a big military that's bigger than anyone else's, you're strong. When you have a strong economy, you build American strength. For me, everything is about strength. And communicating to people what is and is not acceptable. It's speaking softly but carrying a very, very, very big stick. And this president instead speaks loudly and carries a tiny stick. And that's not the right course for a foreign policy. I saw Dr. Kissinger in New York.
You're not eating.
I'm mesmerized.
Yeah. He's bored to tears. I saw Dr. Kissinger. I said to him, how are we perceived around the world? And he said one word, weak. and that's how this president is perceived, by our friends and unfortunately by our foes. And it's no wonder that people like Kim Jong-un, the new leader of North Korea, announces a long-range missile test only a week after he said he wouldn't. Because it's like, what's this president going to do about it? If you can't act, why don't threaten him?